Okay. Hi. How are you? Great. Brian says great. Good. Anybody else great? Wonderful. All right. So from here, only go up, right? Get better. Otherwise, you're going to be a major downer this semester, and we don't want that. So, do you know any good jokes, Talia? What? Knock, knock. Who's there?
Interrupting cow.
Knock, knock. Control freak. Now, you're supposed to say control freak who? All right. Now, how are you? Worse. All right. I think we shouldn't do knock knocks. Okay. You have a great joke. Okay. You want? Wait a minute.
Oh no, I have to go with that.
No, you don't. Just pretend it's not there.
What did the geologist say to, or what did the limestone say to the geologist?
What did the limestone say to the geologist?
Yeah. What did he say? Do you want me to say the answer? Don't take me for granted.
Don't take me for granted. All right. Are you from New Hampshire?
No, I'm not.
Okay. The Granite State, you know. All right. Well, thank you, because I was tempted to tell an Uncle Russell joke, and you could just convince me not to do that. Uncle Russell, I mean Cousin Russell, is my mother's 96-year-old cousin in Florida who emails me regularly, and he sends jokes. And I was going to tell you the one that came last night, but you've been saved by that joke, so we're not going to take that one for granted. All right. HDFS 60, Family Context of Human Development. Syllabi are here if you don't have one yet. The assignment that was due today is here also. If you didn't get it and haven't done it, you can pick it up, turn it in Wednesday in class. We'll still take it. If you brought yours, it goes in this pile, and we'll get those back to you next week. The website is up and running. It has the syllabus on it. The readings are mostly up. The book, the Shelton book, the pretty yellow one, is up and running. If you don't have it yet, I brought copies today. I have a few. And if you don't have money or a check, you can get it in Living Learning. But you do need to get started on that this week so that you are reading in it. What else? Other questions that I didn't just answer? Okay. Then we go, guy. What I said on Wednesday was some version of, if you look at the title, and I assume you do this always in your courses, that you look at the title of the course and figure out what it might be about. And this one is a complex title, so the course is about families and the context and humans and development, all of those rolled up into one. And I was in the process of saying that if we look at human development, we look at it from my perspective. What's important about looking at development is that we're talking about the lifespan from conception to recycling. We break the lifespan down into stages: infancy, toddlerhood, adolescence, middle age, old age. And those are pretty much common knowledge, but if you want a review of those, borrow a book on lifespan developments from somebody and see what the chapter headings are, or I can refer you to other things, or Talia can as well. In between stages, there are transitions, and those transitions are when interesting things happen. Puberty, for example, comes between childhood and adolescence, and we see that during the transitions that take place across development, often the role in the family changes for the person, and sometimes we change where we are. But roles are particularly related to the transitions that take place from stage to stage. So we'll elaborate on that. And I had said something to the effect that when we think about the whole person going through the lifespan, we tend to break that down into the biological characteristics of the organism, the person, the cognitive aspects, our thinking and how that changes across time, the psychosocial domain, and the interpersonal domain, how we relate to other people. So we're just going to assume that those are all happening, and we will elaborate on some of them, particularly in childhood and adolescence, as we go through the course. This course is about families as they provide the context for individuals who are going through the lifespan. So as we look at human families, we're going to be looking at how we develop partnerships. We'll look at partnership relationships. Some of those become marital relationships. Sometimes people who are partners become parents one way or another, biologically or adoptive or foster parents. We'll be looking at the children within families and their sibling relationships, and how the nature of the family and the constellation of the family. We talked about the fact that all of you have at least one sibling, except for a couple of you, and some of you have as many as 9 or 10 siblings. And the constellation of the family is how many siblings there are, what their sex is, their ages, the age differences, how they came into the family. Those all structure the kinds of relationships that siblings have with each other, and those provide part of the context for our growing up. We have relationships with our parents, we have relationships with siblings, grandparents, people in the extended family, creating a whole web of complex of relationships that each of us is in just within the family, not thinking about school and friends and people who might be neighbors, our music teachers. Just within the family, we exist within a web or a complex of relationships with other people. And that's what we're going to be looking at, particularly in this course. And I had suggested that it's important for us to look at individual lifespans within the context of the family, but also the lifespans of people within the family related to each other. The parents' lifespans, the changes that they're going through, the history that they have, occur at different times, but they relate to each other. Where you are in the lifespan is part of the web of relationships that you have with other people, as they typically are in other stages of the lifespan, going through transitions in their own lives that may be quite different from the transitions or the stages that you are in. So we'll be looking at how those relate to each other. And then part of what we're going to be looking at is the context that the family itself is in, the neighborhood, community, the other settings that people participate in, such as work and school, society, and we'll spend not much time looking at how our family reflects historic changes, changes in the culture that may be taking place as we are growing up. Okay. Because that's different for different cohorts or different generations. Your generation is going through late adolescence and early adulthood in the early part of the 21st century. My generation went through adolescence, late adolescence, and early adulthood in the 1960s. The times did change. They were changing, and they did. And we have different experiences. And you've noticed that. Your grandparents talk about things that you don't have a clue about that seem to be really important to them, so you listen and try to figure out what they're talking about. I'll try not to do that too much in here. Okay, so that's what the course is about. Do take a look at the website. It is up. The material is not yet updated. I'll be working on that over the next couple of days. When you start to copy down all the stuff that shows up above the board and that I point at and talk about, remember that almost all of it will be on the website. And once I catch up, you will be able to look at the website and see what I'm going to talk about. So what some people find useful, and probably you've all discovered this already, is when a course website includes the overheads and the board material for the day, it's useful to actually print it out, bring it to class, and take your notes right on it. Then you can see it and you can annotate it as I talk about things. Many times there'll be far too much on there to copy in the brief period of time that I will flash it up there and then take it down. But don't get frustrated because it's on the website. Okay? So, let's talk about some definitions and assumptions as we head into this. When we talk about humans, we're talking about organisms, biological organisms, and those organisms have specific characteristics that are common to all of us. And those are built into the DNA of the species, and each species, of course, has different specific characteristics. Isn't that interesting? It's a species, and it has specific characteristics. That's what specific means. Specific characteristics for a particular species. And we vary in important ways. We're all humans, but we vary in many important ways. One is that there are two general basic sexes, male and female, and they're different from conception. We're born with, some of us believe, different temperaments. Some of us are wired differently than others. We have brains that process information somewhat differently. And so we relate to the world a little bit differently. And families reflect the sex and the temperament and the cognitive characteristics, the preferences, the skills that characterize the particular individuals. So a family may be full of musical people who are very easy to get along with. The family may have one maverick who's smarter than the rest and wired a little more tightly and is harder to get along with and difficult and emotionally volatile. The family process will reflect that difference as well. Families may have people who love to be physically active. Families may have a whole bunch of couch potatoes. The process that goes on within the family and what people are interacting with as they develop will reflect those specific individual characteristics and their style, how they're represented within that particular family. because we're biological organisms, we change biologically across time. You're very different than you were when you were 8 years old. You've changed biologically as well as in other ways. The family is responding to the changes that take place and the timing of those changes as they happen. So, under genetic control, change is going to happen. It's going to happen whether you want it or not, whether you're ready for it or not, whether it makes life easier or difficult. It's just going to happen. And you're going to change constantly. We are also learning organisms. We have a brain and a sensory system that gather information from our experience. We go through the world, we experience that world, we detect particular things with our sensory systems, we process that information that we're taking in, we store it, we act on it, we transform it, and we apply it to new situations that we go into. And so, basic characteristic of human beings is we're constantly changing as we have transactions with the environment. So as we're having those transactions, we're constructing our perception and our understanding of the experience that we have. We're constructing knowledge. We're also constructing a view of ourselves so that we understand how the world works and our place in it. And we're developing skills. We're developing the skills that it takes to get along in the world. How do I find my way to class? How do I drive a car? How do I remember where I parked it? How do I remember where my keys are? How do I put gas in it? How do I read material for a course? How do I remember it? How do I prepare for a test? How do I think about the material that I'm learning? Those are all skills. And we construct those from our experience in the world. And hopefully we're all adapting to the environment. We may sometimes construct skills that allow us to act maladaptively. If I'm going to learn that I can get my way by having a temper tantrum and threatening people and being a bully, and if it works for me, if that's what I construct from the transactions that I have in the world, and I see people doing that, so I figure out, hey, that works, I can get what I want, then I adapt to the experience that I have and become a bully. I become a threatener. I become somebody who has a temper tantrum. I'm perhaps being maladaptive, but if it works for me, it's part of my adaptation to the experiences that I've had. Okay. We're going to come back to each of these points with specific illustrations as we go through the course, so don't worry that I'm not elaborating enough for you at this point, and I will always answer questions. I'll try to answer questions. Okay, so we're biological organisms, and we learn. We're also social organisms. We are social animals that have to be reared by others, and we are typically reared in families, sometimes institutions, but primarily in families. We are social animals who seek and maintain relationships with other people. We like to be with other people, not too much, but if we're not with other people for a long period of time, we tend to seek them out. We also develop emotional reactions, attachments to other humans. There are particular people we like to be with. There are particular people we miss. We write them letters. We email them. We get on the cell phone every hour and talk to them. We also are an interesting species because we develop attachments to usually individual members of another species. How many of you have dogs? And you like your dogs, right? How many of you have cats? How many of you have a new kitten that you got over the holidays and you miss it because it's not here? You're not alone, because I've talked to two other students whose big problem with coming back to school is that they miss the kitten they got over the holidays. So let this be a lesson to you. I don't know what the lesson is, just let it be a lesson. But we do form attachments to other species, and some of us even form attachments to particular plants. My wife and I are having this little go-around about the three plants actually, one of one species and two of another, that are actually quite ugly. They're a little bit of green, but they're misshapen, and they're really not the sort of show plants you'd take to the botanical garden plant show. But she would kill them in a minute, and it would not bother her conscience at all. But she knows that she can't do that, because Larry is very attached to the plants. Very attached to the plants. And I would grieve if she killed them. I will grieve if they die on their own. What she has to do is figure out a way to kill them without letting me know that she did it. So I'm going to check to see what she put in the plant, in the pot. Why do we get attached to plants? Because we've had them around for a long time. The two rubber trees, which are really quite ugly, originally belonged to my son. He picked them out in fourth or fifth grade, and he learned to propagate them, and we used to have many more, but I'm down to two. And so he wants them. So someday they'll get shipped to Albuquerque, buy him a seat on the plane. The other one is this straggly thing that was given to me, to us, on the occasion of the birth of my daughter. 37 years ago. By my best friend and mentor at the time. Okay, so double. Who gave it to me and the occasion. And the family theory, the hypothesis that we don't want to test, is that she thrives as long as the plant does. So we're hoping that it has a lifespan of about 110 years and stays healthy. And the suspicion, it's superstitious, of course, is that if anything ever happened to the plant, it would somehow be reflected in my daughter's life. This is total bogus stuff, but it is the kind of experience and connection with people that makes us have attachments to animals, sentimental attachments to plants, and even to things in our environment. We're a very interesting species because we make those kinds of attachments, and they often direct our behavior. Attachments to things often do. Attachments to people can be counted on to direct our behavior and shape our lives. So the relationships that we develop with people within our families and elsewhere are an important part of our development. And we'll be looking at the nature of relationships and how they direct our development as we go through this course. We develop through experience. We develop through our transactions with people and with the environment. And the fact that we typically have unique experiences help create the variations among us. So you're different from each other and from me because of your DNA. We all have individual DNA, unless we're identical twins, and there are none of those in here, so we can generalize. We're all different biologically. And as we go through life, we have experiences that are unique to us. Nobody else has the same experience that we have. So we construct our own individual, unique understanding of the world. And because our experiences differ, we each understand the world differently. There may be similarities, as there are biologically. We all have, at least at the beginning, maybe the potential for two legs, hair on our bodies and heads, and those sorts of things that are species-specific. We may have similar experiences, but we don't have the same experience. So we are unique because we have different experiences. One of the reasons that we have different experiences is that we grow up in different environments. As our families provide different environments for us, different contexts, we develop differences among us, and the more different our families and our environments are, the more differently we will understand the way the world works. Similarity across our environments will tend to make us see the world in similar ways. So if you and I grow up in very similar environments, we're likely to agree with each other in how we see the world. If we grow up in very different environments, we're likely to understand the world and act in the world somewhat differently. And as we do that, as we experience those different environments, we're likely to create a different style of life, different kinds of activities that are important to us, different motives, different goals, and those will add up to be what we call a trajectory in life. If you're successful in school, if you come from a family that values school and encourages the kinds of skills that are also valued in school, then you're likely to be successful in school and continue in it. And if you continue in it long enough, you decide, gosh, I'll just stay in it. I've been in school since I was 5 years old. Can't leave. My trajectory is rooted to doing well and being in school and staying in school as part of my life. It's a very important part of my life. For some of you, they're quite different trajectories. Some of you do athletics, and your experiences in athletics are successful, and you continue to do those. You've probably been doing them since childhood, and you continue to do them, and many of those activities you will continue, and they will become a trajectory in your life, so that you'll always want to live where you can play soccer, or where you can find a basketball court, or where you can swim. And as you go through life, you'll probably share that experience with other people. So you'll hang out with people who swim, or people who play soccer. I hang out with people who go to school. Our lives are structured differently because way back then we had experiences that shaped how we deal with the world, what we think is important in the world, and where we are successful, what kinds of skills we have for dealing with the environments that we're in. We'll come back and elaborate on that. Okay, the notion of context. I already talked about stages and transitions. What is the context? The context of anything is the set of circumstances or facts that surround a particular event. So our context here. Here we are, 2:35 Marsh Life Science, Monday and Wednesday, 2:30 to 3:45. All semester. The context is whatever else is going on in this building. It is the life sciences building. It's connected to the biology and zoology people in that direction, the plant and soil science people in the other direction. Microbiology, if you keep on going. It's connected. That's part of the context. Part of the context is the university schedule. Part of the context is the fact that we are in a university. Can you imagine being in a class without a university around it or a college? So the marché, the new student center, Billings, the library, Waterman, the registrar, all of that is part of the context in which this class exists. Part of the context is your families, of whatever sort they are, wherever they are. For you individually, your contexts may be quite different. Some of you have family right here, you'll go home with them. Some of you have family who work at the university. Some of you have spouses, I suspect. I didn't ask how many of you have kids or are married. How many of you have kids? A couple of you. How many of you are married? How many of you are partnered? A few of you. How many of you live with a partner? We don't have a lot of experience in here, do we? Okay, I guess. How many of you live in the university residence halls? Oh, that's a different kind of context. How many of you wish you didn't? How many of you are glad you don't? Tells us something about the context. Okay. I'm not going there, but thank you for raising it. I'm not going there. Okay. We're going to be looking at the context and trying to define it for individuals and also for families. Now, yeah. This course is about human ecology, and the stuff that we're going to read by Yuri Bronfenbrenner, he called the ecology of human development. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit. And in the Developcology book, you have my proposed term for the field that he made a major contribution to. And I'll explain why. And I do explain why, and we can talk about that if we need to. But from Bronfenbrenner, the book that laid out most of his understanding of the way development and the context are connected is called The Ecology of Human Development. And he defines ecology of human development in this way. Now, just want to point out to you, for those of you who do see color, this is in color. And I have done something with this that I recommend that people do. Bronfenbrenner was trying to create a scientific view of the ecology of human development. So he was very precise, attempted to be very precise in his terminology and in his presentation of things so that we could argue with him in the first place and so we'd understand exactly how it was to be applied. So he said things like this. This is a single sentence. And it says, the ecology of human development involves the scientific study of the progressive mutual accommodation between an active growing human being and the changing properties of the immediate settings in which the developing person lives, as this process is affected by relations between these settings and by the larger context in which the settings are embedded. Okay, so that's what the ecology of human development is about. And I find it helpful and recommend that you do this as well. I find it helpful to break down compound sentences like this into the components So when I use Bronfenbrenner's work, which we will go through in great detail, when I throw it up here, it will be in color, and that will help us isolate the specific components that we need to put together in order to understand his definitions and hypotheses. The offer is, if you want a Word document that includes all of these that I'm going to use with the color emailed to you, I will do that, because I can simply email you the document in which I have added all these wonderful colors. So if that would be useful to you to have to print out or to put on your computer and consult as you're trying to understand his concepts, if that would be helpful to you, just email me and then I will reply and attach the document for you, so you'll have your own colorful overheads. What's on the website and what's in the book are not in color. And I can't put his definitions and concepts in toto on the website because of copyright issues, but I can send it to you. Just don't tell Harvard University Press, or somebody will get in trouble, and it's likely to be Talia or me. Okay, the ecology of human development is what we're looking at. He's trying to do a scientific approach to ecology. And what he wants to understand is the progressive mutual accommodation. What that means is the transaction, the progressive, the ongoing mutual accommodation that takes place, the changes between an active growing human being and the changing properties of the immediate settings in which the developing person lives. What that means is that you have a person, and that person is relating to an environment, particularly settings, places, and there's a relationship going on between these two. And the person is active and growing, which means the person is changing. And as the person changes, the relationship to the settings or the environment changes. So as you learn to walk, part of your growing, you changed your relationship to the setting. Your parents had to childproof it. When you learned to crawl, they had to put gates on the stairs. When you learned to walk, they had to put bigger gates on the stairs. They had to put locks on the gates. When you became a teenager, they had to put a lock on your room to keep you in. No, and they probably didn't do that. But your relationship to the environment changed as you went through puberty. As you get old and mobility decreases, it gets more difficult. Maybe your balance, as you hit 95, your balance may be not be quite as good. So you discover that your relationship to the environment changes because of those biological changes taking place. At the same time, the environment changes. They take the carpet up and put down hardwood floors. They put a stop sign in. You go into a different classroom in school. The semester ends and you start a new one. Those are changes that are happening outside, and they change your relationships with the environment. So Bronfenbrenner is trying to capture in the study of human ecology the fact that people are constantly changing, environments are constantly changing, and therefore the relationship between them is constantly changing. The person is changing in the transaction with the environment as it changes. As the person changes, the person is changing the environment, which then has to respond to the new characteristics of the person. The transactions are what happens between the person and the environment, and they are constantly changing. So the notion of human ecology, the ecology of human development, is that we have an active growing human being, and immediate settings which are constantly changing, settings that person lives in, and this process, the mutual accommodation, the constant adaptation of the two to each other, is affected by the relations between the settings. Oh dear. It's not just one environment. We have a couple of settings, or half a dozen settings. And he's asserting that the relationship between those settings is also affecting this mutual accommodation in the transaction between the person and the setting. So if we look at one setting at a time, the other settings that that setting relates to may be affecting what's happening to us. So we have to look at not just one setting or place that we're in, but all the settings that we're in, and maybe some settings that we're not in that affect the settings and us in other ways. So we're going to look at that as well. The larger context, the university in this case, the state of Vermont, the State of the Union. When's he giving that? Tomorrow? Bush saying the State of the Union address is happening. That's a larger context in which this classroom is embedded and in which your residence hall is embedded. Okay? So that's what the ecology of human development is about. That constant changing transaction, understanding the settings and how the settings are related to each other and how the broader context that those settings exist in may affect that whole process. So you get to expand your brain, make it big, expand your view of the world, because we're going to put them all together. Now, the term that I throw out in the book is actually the result of a slip of the tongue. But I like it. And now that it's in print, it's a real word. It's not in your dictionary yet, but it's in your book. And I've gotten it published. That's what makes something a real word. And the editor didn't throw it out. The editor accepted it and the definition. So it's a real word now, and it will be in your dictionary. And you can learn to pronounce it. Developology. And you can learn to pronounce the adjectival form, developological. Try that one. Developological, developological, developological. Developologically. You can do the adverbial form too. Developologically. It's only taken me about 5 years to be able to do that, so you better start practicing now. But it's a word that I coined because I literally made a slip of the tongue once when I was trying to say, for the umpty-dozenth time, developmental and ecological. Because that's what Bronfenbrenner is really trying to do. He's trying to make us take a developmental view of people and families and an ecological view at the same time. And the way he described it, you can read it in the book, the various definitions that he's used, but what I wanted to do was to give equal weight to a developmental perspective and an ecological perspective, and the easiest way to do that is simply to use a different term to describe the combined field. So the volcology is what we are studying, and therefore it's the title of my proposed book, and I call myself an applied human devolecologist. And that, I actually got that through the editor, and it was okay. Okay. I'm probably the only one you know. Okay. How about that? Unique. Okay, so what are we trying to do? We're trying to study the processes of development of any organism. We're going to look at humans and the relations with the environments, and we're going to combine systemic and longitudinal perspectives that include the mutual and reciprocal transactions of the organism and the context. And we're going to look at change in both the person and the context. So you can read more about it in the text, but that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to look at development of the person and changes in the context at the same time, and we're trying to keep in mind that we have to continue to look longitudinally, that is, change over time, and we have to think systemically. We have to think about a system. That's what Bronfenbrenner is trying to do. I didn't invent this, I just invented the term, and I've provided a definition that is my attempt to make it more general than his. Who is this guy, Bronfenbrenner? Did any of you Google him? Okay, the other thing you get to do is learn to say Bronfenbrenner and spell it correctly. You get to learn to say Bronfenbrennerian and Bronfenbrennerianly. If you're a human development and family studies major, you will learn to say them and spell them correctly. Yuri Bronfenbrenner was a sociologist who spent most of his career at Cornell University as one of the senior faculty in the College of Human Ecology there in the Department of Child Development and Family Relationships. I'm not going to go into detail about his life, but I don't know what he would have thought about the term devolecology, because he died last year in his late 80s. I think it was 86 or 87. So we lost him, and I've had a number of conversations with him about what I was trying to do, and he seemed to approve, but we didn't get to the term devolecology before he got too sick to correspond with me. So we miss him, and we'll celebrate his birthday when it comes around. This is his definition of human development, and it's an important definition of human development. For those of you who were in 5, last fall, you didn't perhaps bump your nose up against the fact that the human development text that we used never actually defined human development. It was interesting. It did talk about change across the lifespan, but it didn't actually do any more than that. What development means is something that exercises developmentalists, and they write whole books about it occasionally. But it's become common that the textbooks essentially finesse the question. They're afraid to tackle it, because every time you tackle it, you get into assumptions and you get into technicalities that raise more questions than most people want to answer. Bronfenbrenner did not shy away from defining human development, and said, here it is, argue with it if you want. We will use this definition and particularly its implications throughout the course. And I will ask you regularly, well, how would that fit with Bronfenbrenner's definition of development? And when I ask you that question, I want you to be able to think about what does development mean to a Bronfenbrennerian. This is what it means. Okay? Human development is the process through which the growing person acquires a more extended, differentiated, and valid conception of the ecological environment and becomes motivated and able to engage in activities that reveal the properties of, sustain, or restructure that environment at levels of similar or greater complexity in form and content. He's taken a whole bunch of ideas from a long history of writing about what development means. And what he's said is, we're going to focus on the person and the person's view of or understanding of the environment it's in. And this is a very, very important and rather radical definition. We're going to look at knowledge, understanding of the environment as what development is about. Do you understand your environment? That's what development is for Bronfenbrenner. He's kind of cut to the bone and gotten down to where the rubber hits the road. Because of what isn't in here. It says nothing about stages. It says nothing about your IQ. It says nothing about the size of your vocabulary. It says nothing about your SAT score or your GRE score. It doesn't say anything except your understanding of the world. How do you understand your world? Acquiring your understanding of the world, which I said earlier, comes about from your experience in the world, your transactions with your world, that lead you to knowledge, to understanding. That, for him, is what, that's half of what development is. Your understanding of the experience that you've had, the environment that you're in. The other half is the motivation and ability you have to engage in activities, to act, to do something that reveal the properties of, i.e. help you understand better, sustain, vacuum the floor, sustain your environment, keep it clean, clean the toilet, buy groceries, or restructure that environment, to remodel it, to change it, to reorganize the furniture, to change your class schedule, to change your major, to get into the courses that you need, to learn to put a new operating system in your computer. Restructuring your environment so that it is at least as complex as it was before or greater. Okay. So, development is the combination of those two. Acquiring a valid, complex, and differentiated, that means lots of pieces, lots of parts to it. Understanding of the environment that you live in and the motivation and ability to take care of that environment and to improve it, to adapt to it, to deal with the problems in it. And it's not understanding for its own sake, it's understanding for the sake of being able to maintain and sustain and improve the environment that you're in. He doesn't care what your IQ score is. He cares whether or not you understand the world and can do something about it. He doesn't care what your vocabulary size is. He doesn't care if you can tell me a good story. Unless telling a good story within a particular environment is a useful way to sustain or nurture the environment, which includes the people in it. And so if you can tell a good story, that might be evidence that you can nurture the other people in your environment. You can maintain it, you can help them cope with it, you can help them understand it, and that would be valuable. So, when I ask you, how would you interpret that as it relates to development, there are two pieces to think about. Does it relate to understanding the world better, more clearly, more complexly? And does it relate to being motivated and able to maintain that world? He said, that's what it's about, and that's what counts. Not your GPA, not whether you have a degree or not, but whether you understand the world well and can maintain it. And I look for examples of people whose development is really, really top-notch, and or the other way. I went to college with a guy who was a member of Terman's study of geniuses, and this guy got to college and we became buddies, and he was fairly quick to point out that his IQ was 160-something, and he was in Terman's study of geniuses. And that was his identity. 165 IQ, and he was being studied by Lewis Terman, or Terman's successors, as part of the study of geniuses. Grade point average at graduation, about a C. Practical skills, none that I could imagine, that I could detect. He went through life telling people he had an IQ of 165 and that he was a genius. But he wasn't motivated to do very much, and he didn't have a whole bunch of skill that I could detect. I don't know what he did in his spare time, but he seemed to have a lot of it because he didn't do much in the way of studying. Adult career, not terribly distinguished. Paid his bills. That was about it. And then I like the contrast between two brothers in Minneapolis. One of them was a psychologist with a PhD and a doctorate in social work at the same time. Very, very bright guy. Really, really bright guy. Did a lot of interesting stuff. And fun to be around. Lots of stories. But I liked hanging out with his brother a lot, too, who had a bachelor's degree, didn't go on to graduate school, and knew more about tuning Jaguars. No, I did not own a Jaguar. But I had friends who had this old classic Jaguar that we ran around in when I was a graduate student. And the brother could repair any Jaguar, could figure out what was going on, do it cheaper than anybody else in town, and do it successfully. You would pull into his shop and he'd stand there and he'd put his foot on the bumper and he'd look around. He'd listen to the engine and then he'd ask questions about shifting and cornering, and then he'd say, well, I think you need whatever it was. And then he would do whatever it was, and when you drove out, the car would just purr. And he tuned by ear. He would tune a 12-cylinder Jaguar engine by ear. Just get the timing just right, and they just hum. And if any of you spent much time around Jaguars, you know they're really basically a piece of crap. They require more maintenance than you could possibly want to put into a car unless you had a lot of money and liked the prestige. Boy, did he have a conception of the environment he was in, made a good living at it, and was highly motivated to sustain that environment, every piece of automotive wonderfulness that came into the shop. Let me think about a couple of the other implications of this description of development, if you're going to teach, some of you are going to teach, are you teaching? The more extended, differentiated, and valid conception of the world that you actually live in, are you helping children or others understand that world? And are you teaching them to become motivated and able to engage in activities that help them understand the world even better, to take it apart, to restructure it, and to maintain it? Think about your fourth grade experience. Think about high school courses. Think about other courses maybe you've taken at UVM. Do they give you a more extended and valid view of the world that you live in? Are they contributing to that process? Probably. I hope this one does. We'll see. But that's... remind me to revise the evaluation so it asks, did we? I'm serious. We'll put that on the evaluation for the course. Did it do that? Okay, so that's what Bronfenbrenner is about. That's what the course is about. And instead of looking at all aspects of the environment and all of our relationships and all of our understanding, we're going to look at our family context. But we're going to use Bronfenbrenner's framework to do that. We're going to think about that. Okay, I've used the term ecology. Let's talk a little bit about where it comes from. We're going to use the term ecosystem. And you're familiar with both of those if you got through high school biology. So one of the neat things about this perspective is that it's becoming, over the years, it's become more and more familiar to students to be able to think about an ecosystem and to comprehend it. Back in the bad old days when I was growing up, we didn't understand the ecosystem or an ecosystem perspective very well. It was pretty radical and new. Now it's becoming old hat, and sometimes I still act as if it's brand new, so forgive me that, because that's been part of the experience I've had. Ecology, the relationships between organisms and their environment. It comes from the Greek word for house, oikos, the same root as economics, which refers to household management. The oikonomos was the steward or the manager of a household. So ecology and economics have the same origin, and economics means household management. You didn't know that, right? When you took economics, it refers to household management. That's actually microeconomics. Macroeconomics refers to the whole earth as the household, or the global economy. System is also Greek, and it refers to a whole compounded of several parts. In other words, if it's just one thing, it can't be a system. But the human body, we now understand, is not one thing. It's a respiratory system, and a digestive system, and a nervous system, and a musculoskeletal system. Those are really subsystems of the whole system, which is the human body. There are probably others, the endocrine system. I didn't list them all. But there are several parts to each of those systems, and those parts come together. They're interdependent, and they work together to create something that works or functions differently than any of the parts separately could or would. So just imagine if you were just a skeletal muscular system. You had the bones and you had the muscles, and you had the nervous system innervating it, but no respiratory system, no digestive system, no endocrine system. You know, what could you do? Well, I don't know actually what you could do without any of those other things. But what you do as a human being, what your body can do, depends on the interdependency and working together of all of those different components at the same time. And that's what creates a system. several parts, they work together to do something that is different from what any of them could do by itself. Put them together and we have an ecosystem. It's a contraction. An ecological system, which refers to the parts, the various organisms, and the parts of the environment, each understood separately, but put them together to understand that the various organisms and species of things within an environment work together to modulate each other, to influence each other, to change each other. And our understanding of the ecosystem is based on our ability to see that. If you've got a nice grassy place with a little spring and you put in a few buffalo into that nice grassy plain with a little spring, the buffalo are going to go where the water is. This is predictable. They have to have water. It's part of their need. They can't survive. American bison cannot survive in the desert. They must have water. And so they go where the water is, and they eventually, with their wonderful hooves, tear up the ground where the water is, and they create a mud wallow. And the water collects there, and bison are a wonderful way to create a small pond. They change the environment, because they like to roll in it and cover themselves with mud and get all really yucky. And that protects them from the insects, which are part of their environment, which annoy them a lot. And by coating themselves in mud, in the wallow that they've created with their feet while they're getting water, they are able to protect themselves from the insects. Okay, so the insects have to go bite somebody else or something else. So that's a changing relationship between the organism that we introduced into the environment and the environment, and that changes. In the first place, when we put them in, the insects increased because they were able to bite the buffaloes, and now they, if there is rain and if there is a wallow, then the insects don't get as much blood, so they can't reproduce as well. They have to find something else as a host. So the ecology that you studied in high school biology is full of relationships like that, understanding the predictable and the understandable relationships between the organisms and their environment. And we are going to look specifically at the human ecosystem. The human environments that we exist in and how they affect us and how our relationships affect them. Okay, so we're going to look at that connection. Questions at this point? That's what we're about. So, what do we do as human beings that's parallel to introducing a bison into a grassy plain, or a small family of bison into a grassy plain? Well, think about the grassy plain as being a couple. There they are in their apartment, and then introduce a newborn child into that apartment. Ideally one that they have conceived and born. So here they are, their parents. How does that change the ecosystem for those three now, the two adults and the infant, and the apartment that the adults have been happily living in for a couple of years is fairly stable, and then we introduce this. I'm not going to play around with the relationship or the analogy between a couple of bison and a newborn, but it's worth pursuing because it will have just about as much effect on the environment that we've introduced it to, and they will have an influence on it. And we will be looking at transitions like that, taking an ecosystem that exists, the couple relationship in their apartment as an example, and putting an infant in it. Or having a couple of children and the parents and having the oldest child, the older child, go through puberty and become an adolescent. That will change the entire ecosystem. That's what we're going to look at. And we'll continue on Wednesday. Thank you.